3CR would like to acknowledge the Kulin Nations, true owners, caretakers, and custodians of the land from which we broadcast. 3CR pays respect to elders past and present of the Kulin Nations. We recognise their unceded sovereignty.
This is 3CR Breakfast. Oh, yeah. Alternative news, analysis, and current affairs. Monday to Friday, 7 a.m. to 8:30 a.m. Only double. Clap your hands. Good morning, listeners. You're on Wednesday morning breakfast on 3CR, 8:55 a.m. Today is not an ordinary day, and I'm not your regular Wednesday host. My name is Pauline Batuna. I'm the Disability Day worker for 3CR. Today is the annual 3CR Disability Day broadcast. This is a day when us disabled folks, chronically ill folks, and neurodivergent folks take over the airwaves for 12 hours of radical radio programming. Every year our broadcast has a theme, and this year it's Right Relations and Innovations. It's 7 a.m. and my co-host for the next 90 minutes is Ayan Shirwa.
Hello everyone, my name is Ayan. I am a former 3CR broadcaster and I've been kindly invited to join Pauline on 3CR's Disability Day.
Yeah, and so today we're going to be playing you lots of clips and interviews, and so we'll be discussing some news and current affairs. Yeah, we'll go from there. Ayan, what's coming up on today's show?
So today, from my end, I am going to be playing two clips from my podcast, which is called Our Stories, Our Flats, and it is about the lives of residents who call the Carlton Flats home. So I've chosen two clips that I feel like embody the essence of what I'm trying or what I tried to do with the podcast. And we are then going to discuss that podcast. Pauline's going to ask me a bunch of questions about my, I guess, the purpose, my passion, and the outcome of the podcast. And then we are going to be talking about disability and innovation. And I'm excited to introduce Pauline to Caption with Intention. And that is something that I will discuss later in the program.
Yeah, and we're also going to be playing an interview that I did with Dr. Lina Kolelat, a Lebanese and Palestinian scholar and the secretary of the Institute of Postcolonial Studies here in UM. She'll be talking about resisting the erasure of Palestinians from public space and anti-racism in universities.
And we're also going to hear some of the late great disability rights activist Alice Wong's talk, The Last Disabled Oracle. And we will be also discussing some of the ethics around disability innovation and tech.
Yes, and I'm also going to be playing a fantastic part of an episode of the 3CR program Yilliman, where host Kieran Stewart Basseton, who is a UN man, an Indigenous custodian who identifies as neurodivergent, about sovereignty as practice and how accomplices can a support mob already building futures of self-determination, sovereignty and liberation. So as mentioned, the Disability Day theme this year is Right Relations and Innovations, and I thought I'd just explain a little bit about the thinking behind that theme this year. So it's kind of two big concepts that kept coming up again and again during conversations that I had this year with people from the disability community and other movement communities as well. So firstly, with regards to right relations, the term itself, right relations, is from the Indigenous Rights and Land Back movement from North America Turtle Island context, which refers to the need to restore Indigenous custodianship over lands and waters. And so that's literally the relationship between human beings and every other life form and the land itself. And so it's this idea that we have to put things into right balance, and settlers and settler migrants need to come into right relationship with the Indigenous custodians of the land. And so I was thinking about that and talking about it with a lot of different folks in disability justice this year, and also looking at the current Australian context as a migrant settler, where we've seen, you know, it's been another sad year where governments have blocked Indigenous land protection efforts and have facilitated violations of country across the continent. And then I've also seen as we've all seen, police violence against disabled Aboriginal people. And all of this was happening at the same time as debates around treaty and, of course, the Victorian State Treaty Bill, which has now passed into legislation. And all of that was happening at the same time as debates were occurring about migration and an increase in white supremacist fascist organising. And of course, we all saw that culminate back in August with the Nazi attack of camp sovereignty being a really visible turning point, I think, on this land. And so all this was happening, and I was thinking about treaty and the different debates about treaty that's happening, you know, amongst the settler population, but also amongst First Peoples of this land. And I thought about also what anti-fascist thinkers were saying was the best antidote for fascism, which is relationships and strong community bonds. So all of that was happening, and I was thinking about, as my position as a settler migrant, what is the responsibility of myself and people like myself. What I came to, the conclusion that I personally came to, and that lots of people from my community came to, was that no matter what form treaty takes and what First Peoples decide for themselves on this continent, the responsibility of the rest of us living on this land is to sort out our relationships with mob, sort out our relationships with First Peoples and with the lands that we live on, and all the different mobs whose lands that we live on. And so I decided to focus on that rather than treaty itself. So that was one big idea that kept coming up again and again this year. And then we also saw lots of different debates about innovations that were happening at the same time. All throughout the year, I was seeing conversations amongst disabled people about different innovations that were coming up, different tech innovations, innovations that are both harmful and also really beneficial, and innovations that we need. And I was also seeing a lot of innovation from disabled people innovating ways to survive and adapt and solve problems. And so these are the two ideas that kept coming up again and again during the year. And so I just decided to put them together, and that's how we came to the theme, Right Relations and Innovations. Now, normally on The Breakfast Show, the hosts will share news headlines, but today we're going to highlight some local events related to disability and the theme of this broadcast that you're invited to. So the first one I want to mention is an event taking place next week. The title of the event is Queering Home, a Storytelling and Spoken Word event. And it features an exciting lineup, including Jax Brown, who's a well-known disability rights advocate, Kanika Chopra, Darcy Green, and Elijah Money. And it's all happening at Brunswick's Library on Friday, December 12th from 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. And you can find out details, access information, and get tickets by searching for Queering Home, a Storytelling and Spoken Word event online. It's going to be an intimate evening of storytelling that explores the beautiful, complex, and revolutionary ways that LGBTQIA+ people create home. And as mentioned, Jax Brown, who is an esteemed disability and LGBTQIA rights activist, writer and educator, will be talking about his queer family. And he and his partner thoughtfully create queer family and have been speaking about this for some time. So I thought it would be a good event to mention today, as so many people on the broadcast are talking about relationships and our relationships with the people we form homes with. Another event that is coming up is called the Disability Oration, coming up tomorrow night at the Arts Centre Melbourne. The BIPOC Creative Access Collective have invited us to an evening of reflection, listening and peer exchange on the role of cultural humility and collective care to sustain Indigenous, Black and persons of colour identifying artists with disability. And so this event is for the community of creative BIPOC with disability and will feature a conversation panel of practitioners who work across cultural health, well-being and the arts, and who will be responding to questions collated from the community. So this is a hybrid event. It will be Auslan interpreted with panelists self-describing, and that's happening tomorrow night, 4th of December, at the Showroom Arts Centre, Melbourne. Later on today's broadcast at 1 p.m, you can hear an extended interview I did with two of the members of the BIPOC Creative Access Collective, Pearl Black and Natasha Paris. The third event that I want to mention is one that I just found out about. It's called the Ableist City Symposium, coming up on the 10th of December, and it's taking place at Melbourne University's Ian Potter Auditorium, and you can attend in person or online. It's a free one-day symposium that will focus on the theme of transformative solutions for inclusive development, the role of innovation in fueling an accessible and equitable world. And so it's drawing inspiration from last year's exploration of spatial justice and the physical and attitudinal barriers faced by individuals with disabilities. For more details on that, you can search for the 2025 Ableist Cities Symposium. And this actually reminds me that there is a program airing today at 9:30 a.m. on Melbourne Public Transport and Innovation. It's presented by William McGrawty and Tilda Joy. And this program will cover disabled people's relationship to the public transport network in Melbourne, centering the lived experience of a vision-impaired and neurodivergent traveller. So be sure to tune in today at 9:30 to hear that fantastic program. We're going to take a little break now and play a song by Iconics. East Kimberley artist from Kukaja and Pinjubi mobs. She is blind, has fought incredible odds of distance and disability to bring her debut album to the national stage. This track is the first EP of her debut album, and it's called Black on Track.
Welcome back. You are listening to a special episode of Wednesday Breakfast. It's part of the 3CR Disability Day. So right now I am excited to introduce to listeners who haven't had a chance to hear my podcast, Our Stories, Our Flats. So Our Stories, Our Flats is a four-part series about residents, a few residents that I spoke to about living in the Carlton flats, in public housing, the highs, the lows. Each episode is about a theme that I found interesting. So themes on accessibility, it can be themes on growing up in the flats, so being a young person in the flats, safety. And it was a podcast that I did with 3CR in collaboration with 3CR. And it was also in collaboration with City of Melbourne, who was able to provide us with a grant. So everyone I interviewed was able to be paid for their expertise, their stories, which I thought was very important for me. So today we are going to play two clips from our stories at Flats.
Before we get to that, can I ask, what was the most challenging part of putting this project together?
There were several. So maybe I can start with the rewarding bit. So rewarding was just speaking to the community and hearing what their interests are, their challenges. That was interesting because I don't get to see or be in community with my community. We all live in the same area, but unless I'm actually going out of my way to speak to people and get to know them, those chances don't often happen. There's no opportunity for us to get to know each other outside of the work that I do. So I work in the community. So that was interesting, getting to know my community. The challenges were trying to find time that worked for everybody, trying to get people to talk at length, getting people to feel comfortable to speak to me, ensuring that people felt heard, just basically creating a platform that was welcoming, that was inclusive, that felt safe. So a lot of the work was prep work, so before getting them on the mic, and that was a lot of reassurances, a lot of, you know, trying to figure out what they wanted to talk about and why they wanted to talk about it. And so all the pre-work was the biggest challenge for me, but once they got on the mic, that was the easy bit.
Wonderful. And are there more episodes planned in the future?
Yes, Juliet, who is the project coordinator at 3CR, her and I, we've just been talking about potentially doing a second podcast. So what that looks like, we're not sure yet, but because there was so much interest and demand from the community, it is something that is in the works, but we're still trying to, I guess, figure out what angle we're going to take.
And the two clips that you've selected to play today, could you talk a little bit more about what each of them is about?
Yeah, so the first clip is Robbie Thorpe. Robbie Thorpe is an advocate. He also hosts the show Bunjil's Fire, which is a 3CR program. So I spoke to him. He is one of the first people who you hear in the first episode. So he's actually the first person. He kicks us off. And it was important for me to have someone who has intimate knowledge of fighting for land. It's just a bit inappropriate for me to talk about living on, I guess, stolen land and to talk about my plight without first acknowledging how what I'm facing is an ongoing part of colonization. So Uncle Robbie spoke to me, and then in this clip, he talks about the neglect of the flats, which he thinks is intentional. And I guess if these buildings are intentionally neglected, then it can be used as a justification to demolish it. But no one talks about how these flats got here. It's not because, you know, people are dirty or people don't care about where they live. People have been fighting for, you know, better homes and cleaner homes and safer buildings, but the government or housing hasn't listened to us. And now all of a sudden, all of our demands are being met, but not on our terms.
It was a lot more closer as a community they lived. And that was a community in itself, those flats. And that area of flats, they were all a part of, everyone knew each other. And, you know, and I think it just seemed to be cleaner. There was more workers, mainstream jobs, actually looking after them places, cleaners. I think it's got a bit rough lately. I think they're allowing it to be run down. And what's happening where I live is there's actually people living in the laundry areas where it throws you off a bit. You don't want to go washing your clothes there, they disappear, and it's a pretty rough element in those places at the moment. I think that's part of the whole scheme of things too, moving some pretty rough groups into those places, intimidate the families, and that's what's happened. And a lot of them are disappearing out of there, they're moving out. If you had a look at the flats, it's my guess, in all those 44 flats, they're probably half empty. I know that's a bit much saying, but a hell of a lot of those places are empty. And these places aren't bad places. They're not bad accommodation. I quite like it where I am. It's large, two-bedroom, fantastic space. I don't mind being up there on the 17th floor. It's a bit like I've got a bird's-eye view. It's beautiful. I see the sunrise. You know, and I had some beautiful community around me just recently. They've started to disappear in the last 3 to 4 years. I like creating a bit of a facade too. You know, the bottom floors are all nice and clean, but you go up further, it's rough as anything. They're renovating these places at the same time they're saying they're pulling them down too. You know, like it's a bit weird. A lot of wasted expenses here going on. They haven't been very direct to the communities. There's basically no consultation. So, you know, I'm waiting to see something, an invitation to a meeting or, you know, where they can engage with the people in the community. They're not really doing that. There was one the other day which I missed, but, you know, there hasn't been much of that. And if people actually knew what was going on, they'd be up in arms.
And then the second clip is an interview I did with Saddam Ahmed, and Saddam discusses accessibility issues in the flats.
No, I didn't get anything accessibly. I just heard it through the grapevine, and also, you know, there was some door knocking that was going on, but I didn't get any accessible literature or anything like that. That's a good example, I think, as well, that, you know, documentation wasn't handed out in accessible format, and you know, it just was very poorly conveyed. And even now, I think it's a lot of the details are quite murky. I mean, to this day, so I hope for the best that something like this will have a positive effect. But you know, it's a grand scale of movement. I think there will be disappointment and tears, but maybe a fresh start is, I think, good. But it's definitely poorly mismanaged and not conveyed well at all.
So, with the building, how would you describe the accessibility standard? Is it accessible? And if not, what could be done differently?
There's Braille on the lifts, and the lifts do talk. But I think that the design of getting around it, I think, can be sometimes challenging. Certainly where I am, I found the previous building that I was in was more conducive to a blind person to get around. You know, a lot of places here, like they're adjacent and there are corridors that go into different to funny places, that kind of thing. So definitely some of the buildings are more friendly than others, I would say.
You're listening to The Breakfast Show on 3CR's Disability Day broadcast.
Disabled people are worth every bloody penny. I'm okay with spending money on the supports that we need.
There's more than 400,000 people who should be on the DSP, but are on JobSeeker instead.
I've got a life to live. I've got commitment. Like everybody else in society.
The only way to provide meaningful support is stronger grassroots movements. These institutions are never going to be our saviour.
If everyone was the same, it would be a boring old world we live in.
We need to do a lot of work in this country around shifting community attitudes towards people that don't fit the white, able, straight, cisgendered person.
3CR. Stay tuned, stay radical.
Hello, I'm Rory McLeod. I live in Scotland and I love radio. I can do the washing up, I could be in the garden, I could be in the car driving. Well, I'm listening to 3CR, Radical Radio. It's a subscription radio, community radio on 855 AM. We do stream at 3cr.org.au. So you can become a member and donate money.
You're listening to the Disability Day broadcast on 3CR. My name is Pauline Vatuna. I'm the Disability Day worker. The following is an interview I did with Dr. Lena Colelat. Dr. Lena Colelat is an academic fellow at the Australian National University. She is an ethnographer and an historian of Lebanese and Palestinian descent. Her teaching and research interests are religion, race, culture, social movements, and refugee studies. Dr. Lena Colelat is also the secretary of the Institute of Postcolonial Studies here in NAM. I personally met Lena through the Disability Justice Network a few years ago now, and Lena also was one of the editors of Demos Journal's Disabled Oracles edition. Today, we're going to be chatting about Palestinian representation, activism, and an upcoming edition of Demos on the 110 days of the ANU Gaza Solidarity Encampment.
Pauline, can I just start by acknowledging that I'm joining you today on the lands from the lands of the Ngunnawal and Ngambri people, where I live and study and work. And want to acknowledge that these lands have never been ceded, always was and always will be Aboriginal land. And when we as Palestinians do acknowledgement of country, we don't take that lightly. It's not just a symbolic act, but it's also a very important part of our resistance to keep saying the names of the towns and villages. I personally come from Jaffa in Palestine, and that town, that city has been, the name of that city has changed, and now not many people call it Jaffa, so it's very important for us to call the places based on what the First Nations people of this land have called them, and to say and re-say these names publicly and openly.
So, Lena, for those who don't know, could you tell us a bit about the Institute of Postcolonial Studies and your role in it?
So I would like to start by saying, Pauline, that thank you for inviting me to have a chat about this. The Institute of Postcolonial Studies has been a very special place for a lot of community members to gather and work and study and read together and to mobilize. And it had gone through quite a big transformation over the last 2 years, as you might have all heard about. So for the last 2 years, we have been me and the new team on the board trying to rethink the Institute as an institute being on stolen land, and understanding how we can strengthen the connection and the work that we are doing at the Institute based on the First Nations people whose land the Institute is based on, and how do we undo some of the harm that the Institute, being part of academia and being part of a larger leftist politics that has inevitably caused harm throughout its existence. So we are trying to do some deep work with community on how to how to fix some of the issues that that have harmed, and how to move forward with an institute or a space. We're actually also questioning these days the terms of the name of the institute, whether it should be called an institute, and whether it is post-coloniality that we are interrogating in this time and age that we live in.
And earlier this year, Palestinian activist, mother, community organizer, and scholar Tasnim Samak, who is a leader in the Free Palestine Coalition, NAM, she's active in union organizing and direct actions against weapons manufacturers, she reminded allies that we hold a collective responsibility to fight back against, quote, the attempted disappearance of Palestinians from public space. And the Institute of Postcolonial Studies heard the call and responded. So could you tell us about the teach-ins and webinars featuring Palestinian scholars and thinkers that have been held through the year?
So basically, that's a very good introduction. My sister and friend, Dr. Tasnim Samak, and my sister and friend, Dr. Natalie Einfield, who's also on the board of the Institute of Postcolonial Studies, came together because we have started witnessing in the last 2 years the silencing of Palestinian scholars and activists in academia and in our university campuses. A lot of seminars and workshops on Palestine had been cancelled, or when they took place, they were vandalized. There's a few examples that I could think of where a session on Palestine or a workshop on Palestine was taking place, and the online session was vandalized and attacked, or before the event even took place. The organizers were attacked, and then the event had to be cancelled. So we noticed the cancellation of voices of Palestinian scholars, thinkers, and activists, and we wanted, through IPCS, to provide a space for Palestinians on this continent to have a voice, to have a conversation, and to share their ideas, their books, their theories, and the work that they are doing. There's a lot of amazing work out there. So that series, that special series that has been organized with the three of us, have featured amazing scholars and writers and activists, and we intend to continue with that series for next year. We are running this series online, mainly for accessibility, but also because a lot of the Palestinian diaspora in so-called Australia is scattered. So to make sure that people from across the continent are able to join and listen and think and ask questions.
At this time, I can't help but think about the violence that is occurring on universities. Could you talk a little bit about your work on anti-racism at the university and within academic institutions?
Of course. Anti-racism has become more of a buzzword in the left, but universities, similar to our society and other institutions in our society, is a mirror to what's happening in our society. So, you know, as we see on the streets and in the public sphere, there is a more racist kind of discourse that's becoming more, getting more traction and occupying more spaces. And there's a lot of that in a lot of our educational institutions. So some of the work that I'm doing is to think about and think through how do we include anti-racism frameworks and theories into universities, into the academic work that we are doing, but also in how we train and work with our student bodies and the communities on campus. That's not an easy work, and I think there's been a lot of initiatives across the country about how to implement anti-racism, but it is a very multifaceted issue, and therefore the approach to working with that is also multifaceted and difficult and complicated. And I guess universities, similar to other institutions, on this continent are struggling through how to make sure that the work that we are doing in public education institutions is anti-racist, is grounded in anti-racism, and to make sure that our students, when they come to study on university campuses, which also hold historically a lot of issues of oppression and violence on First Nations land, how do we make sure that we also provide opportunities and protect and support students that come from all different walks of life, and make sure that they are not being attacked or dehumanized in the process of their education journey.
Speaking of students, you're working on an upcoming edition of Demos Journal on the 110 days of the ANU Gaza Solidarity Encampment. Can you tell us about it?
Yes, this issue is being launched this week, actually, on the 5th of December. This is an issue that has been edited, written and compiled by students who participated in the ANU Gaza Solidarity Encampment last year. And the intention of the special issue is to create an archive of the movement. The Gaza Solidarity Encampments popped up all over the country, all over this continent, and they've created a new wave of activism and created as a Palestinian, Pauline, it was very important for us to see these encampments, because until that time it was kind of what was happening in Palestine, the genocide was kind of unspoken about and people would not acknowledge it. And having the students start these encampments was crucial in bringing the issue here, because we are here, and having to look at what was happening and talk about what was happening in Gaza every day on campus was a very powerful movement that the students brought in. So the Demos Journal 110 days, it's called, brings together an archive of students and staff and activists and community members who participated in the ANU Gaza Solidarity Encampment, and trying to reflect on that, because of course a lot of our institutions try to erase that memory of what had happened. We often see that universities glorify social movements a few years after the issues are done. During the movements, there's a lot of hostilities, but then later on, every university campus wants to think of their campuses as a vibrant social movement hotbed. But always that history is sanitized. So we're trying to give the student a voice where they can write their own history, reflect on their own movement, tell us the story of what had happened, who was there, who was supporting them, and what did they achieve, and what could they have achieved, what did they want to achieve that they didn't, reflect on the encampment's demands, as you might have known and your listeners might have known, that the encampments have demanded that our universities divest from weapons manufacturing and cut ties with Israel, along with other demands. And in most of the situations, the demands were not met. So it's a kind of that special issue as a space to archive and reflect on that movement. And to place it properly within the history of student activism in so-called Australia.
Terrific. And where can people get the Demos Journal?
The printed copies would be best collected at the launch or through contacting the students and staff and community members who were involved in the encampment. So if you know anyone, they would have copies, physical copies, but the journal issue will also be online at demosjournal.com, and all the articles and the pieces will be accessible through the website as well.
Dr. Lena Kolelat, thank you for your time.
Thank you so much, Pauline.
Because the Palestinian fight isn't just the Palestinians' fight, it's all our fight, because it's a fight not just about land, it's about a fight for freedom.
Everybody should be standing here today saying, free Palestine. solidarity with our Palestinian brothers and sisters on behalf of the Gumbanja Nation, my people, who've never ceded their sovereignty.
We should be recognising Palestine as a state and recognising the rights of Palestinians.
3CR, stay tuned, stay radical.
Right to be in public space, undertaking political activity. That is not something that people should be telling us that we can't do.
Multiple actions rolling over months and years and create huge sustained pressure of social change.
And what we're seeing around the country right now is increasing repression of protest.
Protest works. That's why I think we're seeing it criminalised all over the place.
3CR, stay tuned, stay radical.
GCR Radical Radio.
So in this next segment, we are going to be talking about disability and innovation and what that looks like. So I chose a news item about captioning. I chose this story because I love watching movies, but lately I've found it hard to follow the dialogue. I've noticed that I am turning on captions more often. Apparently, dialogue is harder to hear nowadays because of new mixing and speaker technology. If you are a film buff who is deaf or hard of hearing, you rely solely on closed captioning. Unfortunately, traditional captioning just doesn't cut it anymore. With traditional captioning, you don't know who's speaking or the emotion or tone of the speaker. All of this is about to change with Caption with Intention. This new system is expected to revolutionize how hard of hearing viewers experience entertainment. The way Caption with Intention works is that it uses different colors and font sizes to create a more immersive experience. For example, louder voices will now be shown in larger font, while whispers will be in smaller text. And different colors will represent different characters. It's open source, meaning that anyone can use it. Caption with Intention was developed by FCB Chicago, an advertising agency in partnership with the Chicago Hearing Society and the film company Rakish Entertainment. Fun fact, the creative director of FCB Chicago, Bruno Mizzuti, is a child of deaf adults.
And it's actually interesting how much of innovation is driven by disabled family members and disabled people having to innovate ways to survive and access things. Thanks for sharing that. I've been thinking a lot about innovation and tech a lot as well. And just kind of noticing more because of what I'm working on at the moment, just noticing how many things around me are disability tech, like they're things that began as disability tech that became mainstream access and kind of novelty items for the general public. But I've also been trying to learn a lot about AI related innovations at the moment and kind of working through my own prejudices, but also like valid concerns about it as well. I think something that really I struggle with in regards to AI is that the infrastructure that allows for AI is, I would argue, deeply unethical. And, you know, it includes extractive mining in the global south, as well as data centers, like all across the planet, including in North America. We've seen that they require an obscene amount of fresh water to run and sort of create health problems for the local population, which then creates more disability. So, you know, we see benefits to disabled people, but also disabled people being created by it. And of course, the communities that are affected are usually poor communities as well. And at the same time as all of that, there's like a hugely beneficial application for AI innovation for disabled people. I believe actually at the UN this year, there were presenters from Australia, disability rights presenters, who talked about the potentials for AI. And someone I actually follow on Instagram the other day who has recently lost a huge portion of her hearing. She's not really affiliated with the disabled community, but she's suddenly become a member of it. I was watching her stories and she was demonstrating these glasses that a friend of hers basically donated to her that translate what someone is saying into text and project that inside the glasses. So it's like this person can see captions in real life when she's looking at someone. And as someone who is still learning sign language, it's like it's essential. It's a lifeline because she doesn't have the community language yet to be able to converse with other people who are hard of hearing or deaf. But in the meantime, as she transitions and finds that community and she's still around all of her hearing friends, she can still be a part of conversations and things like that. So I thought it was really interesting to randomly see as I'm working on this broadcast. And yeah, it just kind of reminded me that there's like an infinite number of applications for AI for disabled innovation, but also in the realm of disease prevention and cures. And this is another place that can get really murky ethically, because when we're talking about eradicating disabilities, you know, we're also talking about eradicating groups of people who are discriminated against and the cultures that those people on the margins create and the beauty of those cultures. And so recently I received a copy of Against Techno-Ableism, Rethinking Who Needs Improvement. It's a book by Ashley Hsu, who is an associate professor of science, technology and society at Virginia Tech and specializes in disability studies and technology ethics. And I cannot wait to get stuck into it over the next month or so as AI takes over our social relationships more and more. And also when we're seeing these technologies being used as weapons of mass disabling through military weapons and things like that. But I think the book also examines the implications for things like gene therapies. And I wanted to play for you now an excerpt of a talk that the late great disability rights advocate Alice Wong gave. I think it was given in 2020. It's called The Last Disabled Oracle. And it's basically a postcard from the future talking about a future where gene editing is a common practice and people like her no longer exist.
Here we are. Disabled oracles since the beginning of time to ordinary society and telling our truths. And be completely sidelined once again. This is nothing new or unique. Throughout history, marginalized, troublesome, or undesirable people were not believed or taken seriously. We elicit discomfort and disrupt people's binary ideas of normalcy. Our warnings have been silenced in order to uphold the status quo. Even when we make persuasive arguments, we are not at the center, despite our extensive scholarship and wisdom. For instance, I interviewed Dr. Jaipreet Verdi in August 2020 about her book, Hearing Happiness, Deafness, Cures, and History. She said this about the future of cures, such as human gene editing. Screen share, please. Quote, "There is no guarantee that genetic engineering will eradicate hereditary deafness, nor any certainty that it will not cause any further complications. Moreover, this is essentially, at its core, a form of cultural genocide." Next slide. "To argue that this needs to be avoided at the level of genetics is an affront to generations of deaf people who do not perceive themselves as genetic defects." Screen share off. That was a brief overview of our origins. And I share this because the mission remains constant. We tell our stories and truths in our own words. We define who we are and our place in the world. We fight to be seen and heard. We live in defiance with joy and radical acceptance. You voted me as the president of the Disabled Oracle Society this year, and I take this responsibility seriously. Friends, I too am tired of defending my worth every day to people obsessed with having everything faster, shinier, newer. We try to reach people where they are, engaging in a number of creative ways. We assert the danger and uncertainty to future generations with altered genomes and how it will impact the entire human race. We repeat our big talking points all the time, that all people have worth, that no person should be left behind, and that technology is never neutral. We also try to point out how technology reinforces white supremacy, ableism, and all forms of structural inequality. This is not due with too many tragic examples to list. What can we do? How do we love and hold each other up so we can keep going on as a community? How do we harness our imagination to create a world we want to live in right now and in the future? At this time, I'd like to open it up for discussion and questions. Let me see here. I'm Emily from New York City. What is the role of a disabled oracle? Well, thanks, Emily. It's totally up to you. What are you comfortable talking about? Just living your best life is a form of resistance. As I mentioned earlier, I don't have the answers or even a strategy yet on how to engage with the candidates and the millions who have become their customers. But I'm good at asking questions. I'm good at telling my personal story within a larger political context. In asking questions, I want people to consider other perspectives and why germline human identity is incredibly troubling and problematic for so many communities, not just disabled people. Since we're almost out of time, here's one final question. Hi, I'm Grace from Tempe, Arizona. A long time disabled oracle. I'm scared. What is the point of doing all of this if we're going to become a state? Thanks, Grace. I'm really scared too. Things feel overwhelming and impossible every day. Just know that you have a choice on how much you want to do. I believe everyone has the capacity to change the world while we are still alive, in big and small ways. Raise your please. I am reminded of this tweet from 2017 by Dr. Ruah Benjamin, a sociologist and author of Race After Technology, Abolitionist Tools for the New Jim Code. Quote, remember to imagine and craft the world you cannot live without, just as you dismantle the ones you cannot live within. Stop seriously. As disabled oracles, we continue to build and create on the knowledge and dreams of our ancestors. They left their mark on the planet, as will we. After we're long gone, we will show up in other ways. Someone will see and discover us, and we'll be speaking with them from the past. I don't know if this helps, but think about the ancestors that mean something to you. Connect with the people close to you right now and the stories passed down by your elders. Know that we are in this together collectively and that our brilliance as oracles will not be denied. I call upon the power and wisdom of my disabled ancestors, such as Stella Young, Carrie Ann Lucas, Kaite Davidson, Ingwald Ward, Harriet McBride Johnson, and Stacy Park Gilbert. I have my memories and their words to guide me. And I hope this bit of advice brings you comfort, because we should embrace every single moment while we can. In closing, let's read the motto of the Disabled Oracle Society. We are the past. We are the present. We are the future. We are forever. See you all at 2030. Meeting adjourned.
CR Community Radio, 855 AM.
You're listening to the 3CR Disability Day Broadcast Breakfast Show. I'm Pauline Vituna, the Disability Day Worker, keeping you company with Ion Shura. So this year's broadcast has the theme Right Relations and Innovations, and I'm going to play a clip for you now that I think really speaks to this idea of right relations with First Nations people and country. It's of Kieran Stewart Asserton, host of the Yilliman program, which normally airs on Wednesdays at 12 p.m. And actually, if you tune in later, you will hear a special Disability Day episode of the program. In this excerpt, Kieran, who is a Yuin man and Indigenous custodian, talks about rebuilding sovereign Indigenous infrastructures at a ground roots level, and what settlers should practice in terms of labour towards that. Lots of food for thought here. Enjoy.
A lot of the sovereign mob were actually out here building futures where our people survive without this colonial occupation and without having to rely on it. Because for us, the goal has never been assimilation. The goal has never been inclusion. The goal has always been self-determination, sovereignty, and liberation. And we're not waiting for the state to grant it. We're reclaiming it, with or without them. If you want to know where the future is being built, it's not in Canberra. It's out on country, in the hands of our people, and it has very much already began. Now, this is something, of course, that we do look for settler support with. Now, of course, I don't mean that in a way where we want settlers to think that they have the ideas or the solutions for our problems, because they do not. We know from experience that when settlers come out with paternalistic ideas on how to address and fix our situation, that these ideas are very much rooted in that covert racism and that paternalistic racism that sees us and our political and cultural systems as being incapable of looking after ourselves and bettering ourselves and managing our predicaments. What we need instead is labour. We need, you know, resources. We need settlers who are willing to be not allies, but accomplices. Settlers who are willing to actually, you know, put their money where their mouth is, to reach deep into their pockets and to help fund our programs, and to show up and, you know, put in the labour. Go stand on the front lines with us to actually be a part of our struggle. Now, something I often hear is that there's a lot of reactionary nonsense around, right? Where, you know, quite a lot of settlers think that our sovereignty is something that is going to leave them behind. Now, something I've mentioned plenty of times before on the show, but I want to mention again. When we talk about caring for country as First Nations people, now, obviously, we're talking about caring for the land, the waterways, for the plants and for the animals. But we're also talking about caring for people as well. For us, caring for country is caring not just for the land, but everything on that land. That includes the settlers that live here today too. You know, caring for country for us is not about looking after blackfellas and looking after our lands and kicking out the whiteys. It's never been about that. It's about making sure that everyone is actually looked after. Everyone is healthy. So, you know, obviously our sovereignty is not something that seeks to mass deport settlers or, you know, disenfranchise settlers. In fact, quite the opposite. It's something that would actually provide quite a lot of material support to the average working class settler. Now, you take housing, for example. You know, we don't want to become some exploitative landlords. That's not what land back is about. For us, land back is not about taking land and putting it into the hands of a couple of blackfellas who are going to manage it privately as some capitalist investment. For us, land back is about upholding the kinship that our people have with country. You know, land back for us and land ownership, for lack of a better term for us, is very much rooted in kinship, and it's very much rooted in communal ownership. You know, I'm using the word ownership here in a very light sense, because our concepts of ownership are very different to Western concepts of ownership, especially in terms of property, especially in terms of land. A great analogy actually I like to use for this is, you know, and it's such a symbolic thing as well, but, you know, we see the land as our mother. Now, when we look at our relationships, and when I say we, I mean people in general, you know, you don't own your mum, but it's still your mum. You know, it's the person who provides you and your siblings with nurturing and nourishment and whatever else. It's where you come from. And it's also, you know, the person that you, in turn, when you grow up and when they get older, that you look after back, and that you ensure, you know, he's looked after and cared for and fed and whatever else. You know, when we're talking about ownership of land, we're very much talking about it in that sort of kinship ownership of, you know, it's not our possession that we dominate, but it is still I suppose, for lack of a bit of a term, you know, it's somewhat of a exclusive kinship that certain people are privy to and others not so much. Now, you know, when we're talking about land back, we're talking about stuff like housing people, you know, not just housing our own mob, who really do need housing at the moment, very desperately need housing. Our mob is something like 10 times more likely to be homeless than anybody else on this continent, even though this is our own homeland. You know, 10 times more likely to be homeless in our own homeland. Absolutely ridiculous statistic. But we're not talking about, you know, becoming some landlords that are just going to exploit all these settler workers and exploit each other and whatever else. We're talking about owning the land communally, in that kinship sense, and using it to look after everybody on the land. Now, we've got plenty of houses, for example. You know, Australia's homelessness crisis doesn't exist because of a lack of housing. There is very much an artificial supply and demand issue that could be addressed literally overnight. We have more empty homes just sitting there wasting away than we have homeless individuals in Australia. You know, it's absolutely a disgusting statistic. In fact, we have several times the amount of empty houses as homeless individuals. We could house every single man, woman, and child with their own house several times over. But, you know, when we're talking about land back, we're talking about, for example, ensuring that housing is divided up the right way, ensuring that everyone has a house and people aren't out there with investment properties and whatever else, profiting and exploiting their fellow civilians, especially working class people. You know, we're not talking about any of that stuff. So, you know, in that regard, it's, again, something that settlers should really get behind. But even more so, and this is something that Uncle Robbie talks about a lot, we've got this whole issue of ecocide, which is rooted first and foremost in genocide, but this whole issue of ecocide, which will inevitably lead to our suicide if it's not something that we address. Now, when we look at the climate and we look at how rapidly it's changing, when we look at food production systems and how they're starting to fail across the planet, even when we look here in our own backyards of Australia, you know, we see massive, massive issues with this stuff. Australia's got one of the highest rates of deforestation in the world, one of the highest extinction rates, one of the highest rates of stuff like topsoil erosion and dryland salinity. Now, all of these things happen and are continuing to happen because of Eurocentric models of agriculture and Eurocentric models of relating to the land, in particular, you know, that domination ownership and that extraction ownership. So when we're talking about land back, we're also talking about being able to steward our lands the way that we have sustainably for 80,000 years or more to ensure that we're not all marching towards our suicide, to ensure that we can still, as a species, you know, continue to live for several more generations, which is something that, unfortunately, Western systems are completely and utterly incapable of addressing. And we know that they're completely and utterly incapable of addressing it. And it's not just because of capitalism. This is another excuse we often hear, you know, that if there was some sort of settler-led socialist revolution, we could address climate change and rah, rah, rah. But the fact of the matter is we can't, because at the end of the day, these issues aren't just rooted in capitalism. They're very much rooted in European ontologies and epistemologies. Now, if you don't understand what I'm talking about when I start using these technical terms, ultimately what I'm describing here is European ways of thinking, European knowledge systems, and, you know, European ways of relating to the land in general. Now, this is very much something that is incapable of addressing the current problems. We know this because of the whole entire extraction and domination outlook that Europeans have in relation to, you know, ownership of land and extraction of resources and rah, rah, rah. But not only that, they also lack the 80,000 plus years of knowledge that we've accumulated here. Knowledge in terms of how we manage the ecosystems, how we manage, you know, the forests and the bush, and how we manage animal populations and waterways and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Now, again, you know, we know from experience and just looking around us that this is the case. One really telling and really obvious way that we can see this is just simply looking at fire management. Now, for 80,000 years or more, my people very much managed this land in such a way where we didn't have to worry about these big bushfires coming through every single year as we do now. Now, settlers and their institutions, especially the government and, you know, your RFS and CFA and whatever other acronym, depending on what state you're listening in, but all of these firefighting services, right, when they go out and they do hazard reduction burns, they don't do it properly. Now, we used to do hazard reduction burns, for lack of a better term. Fire stick farming is a more appropriate label, though. But, you know, we used to do these burns prior to colonization. But the way we would do them would be completely different to how we see now. We used to do what's known as a cool burn, where we would burn off all of the dead matter. But we would do it in such a way that allowed the animals, even the insects, to be able to escape those flames. And in fact, a lot of the wildlife here on this continent has actually evolved alongside that, those cool burns and that fire stick farming. One really easy example to see is when you go and light a fire out in the bush and you start burning stuff off, you'll see all the insects start climbing up They start climbing up the trees and climbing up the bushes and whatever else, trying to get to the top. Now, the reason they do that is because, you know, our cool burns were very much down on the ground level. And because they were burning a lot colder and a lot smaller than the hazard reduction burns that we see today, insects could actually climb up these plants and they would be safe out of the heat and out of the flames once they got, you know, like 2 meters or meter and a half or however high above the ground. Now, when they do hazard reduction burns today, it's not the case. And all of these insects and other animals that try and climb up these trees and plants to escape the flames very much climb up into this heat zone that kills them because the flames are a lot higher, a lot hotter and a lot bigger. But not only that, it also kills off so much in the bush itself, those actual hazard reduction burns. Now, not only does the high temperature impact stuff like soils and all the, you know, beneficial bacteria and fungi and whatever else that lives in the soil that very much ties the ecosystem together and allows plants to thrive, all of those microorganisms in the soil, they're often killed off by the heat of these burns. Not only that, depending on whereabouts in so-called Australia you are, the heat of these burns can very much bake the soil. So, you know, we've got a lot of clay-dense soils right across this continent. When they're exposed to heat, they dry out more, they solidify more, they become a lot more rockier, a lot more harder, a lot more difficult for the plants to actually live in as a result. And now another thing that these hazard reduction burns do, this is the thing I noticed the most though, whenever I go and see where a hazard reduction burns happened 3 to 6 months earlier, I see so much dead fuel everywhere. Because what happens is these hazard reduction burns, they burn so hot that they kill plants. Now, they don't necessarily catch a light there and then because the plants were very much green and healthy and thriving before the hazard reduction burn. So they got all this water in them, so they don't actually catch a light. But the heat kills the plant. And then it sits there for 3 to 6 months, drying out. And, you know, because it's standing up quite often as well, it dries out even more effectively, even more quicker. You know, when you see a log that's been left laying on the ground, it very much sits there in a lot of moisture because of it's down on the ground. But when you leave a log standing upright, it dries out a lot quicker, a lot more thoroughly. So what happens is these hazard reduction burns take place, and then you come through 3 to 6 months later, and then there's suddenly all this dead, dried out fuel everywhere, ready to fuel the next bushfire. And not only that, it's very much standing up still, quite a lot of it, which makes it so much easier to catch a light. But not only that, it also allows small ground fires to so much easier climb up into the canopies of trees and create crown fires, which are obviously a lot more destructive than your average bushfire. But this is a major problem that we often see with these hazard reduction burns. That and the hazard reduction burns themselves, more often than not, actually turn into bushfires, because these fellas, they don't know what they're doing when they do their hazard reduction burns, and it gets out of control and it starts a bushfire in itself. And it's such a it'll be comical if it wasn't so, you know, so disgusting and so upsetting to see. But it's so ironic that they do these hazard reduction burns to prevent bushfires, and more often than not, inevitably actually create bushfires there and then with the hazard reduction burn itself. But yeah, back to all the dried out trees and stuff. You know, they do these hazard reduction burns during the cooler, wetter months, like over autumn and winter. It dries out for 3 to 6 months. And then what time of the year is it? Oh, it's the hot, dry season. The time when all the bushfires are actually burning. And look at all the fuel they've just created. You know, it's absolutely ridiculous. So, you know, this is just more evidence that the settler population here don't possess the knowledge and the epistemologies and ontologies to be able to actually manage our lands. Now, another big factor I see here that really like evidences this is even in national parks and other areas where they have designated bush regeneration programs and, you know, they're not cutting down the bush and destroying the place as they are over most of the continent. Even in these places where they try and, you know, re-green the place and make it look like the bush again, it doesn't look how the bush looked pre-colonization. It really doesn't. And you can actually go back. There's two ways that you can get the evidence for this yourself if you don't believe indigenous oral traditions and history. Is you can go and look at those diaries from the First Fleet, as well as from Captain Cook's little endeavor. And they talk about this continent being a vast expanse of estates looking like farmland kind of estates that stretch for as far as the eye can see. In fact, the way that they documented it was that it was the most lush and well-maintained estate that they had ever seen. It was more grand and more better than any estate that existed in Europe at the time. And this is written in their very own diaries of the colonizers. This isn't just me saying this. This is the colonizers themselves saying this. But, you know, they talk about how great the place was. But they don't talk about, you know, this big, thick, dense bush. That's not what the diaries talk about. Now, another way we can get the evidence of this is if you go and take core samples of the soil, right, where, you know, you drill in and you take out a big tube of the soil going down and you analyze the years and you go back in time over history and look at how it looked in the past and whatnot, we see that 150 to 200 years ago, the place looked completely different to how it does now. And this even applies to places like those big old growth forests down in Tasmania, where, you know, they call them old growth forests and they make out it's this untouched wilderness. But the thing is, that wilderness only sprung up because the land wasn't being managed by First Nations people anymore. We weren't doing our cool burns anymore. We weren't, you know, managing the land and taking care of everything. And it just grew bushy and wild and overgrown. And that is not how the Australian bush is supposed to look. And I don't just say that as a, you know, as a black fella saying, oh, it's not meant to look this way because we didn't have a look this way. I'm actually talking about the fact that it's actually not meant to look that way at all, even for the health and safety and longevity of the plants and animals of that bushland. Now, a perfect example is these old growth forests in Tasmania I'm talking about. They took some core samples recently and they found that these big, thick wildernesses down in Tasmania only sprung up over the last 150 odd years. Prior to that, there was a lot more plains down there, a lot more grasslands, and the forest and bushland down there was a lot more spread out. Now, this is something that is beneficial for so many of the plant and animal species on this continent. They've evolved to live like that in these open woodlands and these open plains, not these thick, scrubby bushlands that choke out all the light and choke out all, you know, X amount of plant species, and you end up with these monocultures of, you know, one or two types of trees dominating the whole entire bushland, and all of the biodiversity just gone. Now, we also see this right across the mainland as well, not just Tasmania, of course. This is like everywhere that Europeans have impacted our cultural processes of maintaining the land, and we see the same flow-on effects in the animals as well. And another really great example is kangaroos. Now, prior to colonization, kangaroos had all these big open expanses to live in, and where there was bush, it wasn't this thick, dense, scrubby bush that they couldn't get through. Now, don't get me wrong, there's a lot of farmland out there that, you know, we find kangaroos on and stuff like that. But in places where kangaroos are still in the bush has grown so much more thicker and scrubbier that when the kangaroos hop through this bush, they get so ripped up and so cut up from all of the shrubs and fawns and bushes and whatever else, because they don't have an open area to jump through. They get all cut up, and then those cuts get infected. They get filled with stuff like worms, all different kinds of worms and whatever else. And as an end result, it's actually made a lot of kangaroo meat across the eastern coast not really fit for consumption anymore. Like, we can't even really go out and hunt kangaroos anymore in a lot of places across the east coast, because that meat is now filled with worms. Why is it filled with worms? Because it's been all ripped up in the kangaroo's been all ripped up in the bush. Why has it been ripped up in the bush? Because the bush is too thick. Why is it too thick? Because these greenies just think that nature should be something that is just left to run rampant and wild by itself. They don't understand that First Nations people were very much a part of the environment. Now, this is another really big thing. We've only got 10 minutes on the show, so I'm not going to talk about it this episode. But just how there exists a disconnect between Europeans and settlers in general and the land. You know, they very much see the environment and humans as being two separate entities. They don't see themselves as a part of the natural environment and part of these natural ecosystems. But blackfellas were very much a part of the environment and ecosystem here prior to colonization. So, you know, our manicuring and our impacts on the bushland and the way that we looked after it all was very much in line with the ecosystem, because we were a part of that ecosystem. In the same way that, you know, an ant digging a colony is still a part of the bush. You don't look at an ant colony and go, you know, this is an ant-made structure. It's not a part of the environment. No, it's still a part of the environment. Same with blackfellas and the way that we used to manage the bush.
3CR, stay tuned, stay radical.
We demand the full restoration of all Indigenous lands and resources, and we demand the immediate cessation of all forms of exploitation and destruction of our lands.
We're here to remind you of our sovereignty and our original demand from day one.
It started with intentional genocide of our people around the round table in England. It's all lies here. Everything's a lie. It's a great opportunity right now to step into a sovereign, independent republic.
We demand a treaty. We demand our lands back. We demand to stop Black Death in custody.
So we've reached the end of this special Wednesday program as part of 3CR's Disability Day. We're now going to play two audio ability segments. Audio Ability is a free 16-week blended learning program that offers training and mentorship to people with disabilities who are interested in working in radio. Students and their mentors work together to build broadcast skills, gain confidence in the studio, and learn about working and volunteering at local community radio stations. We're going to play for you two of the features produced by Audio Ability students this year. Abby O'Toole's feature on Free to Move, a dance group for people with disabilities, and an audio documentary on the Zunamuf, I hope I'm pronouncing it right, from the Alien movies by Max Miller. Stay tuned for more great programming on 3CR's Disability Day broadcast.
Free to Move is an inclusive, multi-ability dance and singing group based at the Margaret Showgrounds. The group is open to young adults ages 16 and older. I sat down with Sandy Patterson, the group's director, to find out more. Hi Sandy, can you tell me about Free to Move?
Free to Move is an all-ability singing and dancing experience. Okay. I wanted kids to be able to, well, not even just kids, can be young adults as well.
Okay.
I wanted people to get the experience of being in a theatre.
Okay.
So we have costumes, we have mics, we have all of the things that a theatre has.
How can people get involved?
They can be in the show if they're young people that want to be in the show. They can do any serving, they can do sound, they can do lighting, anything they'd like to do.
Okay.
And we always want a nice big audience to see people, so our next show is in June and we'd love to see you there. So come along, have a look at the show, and if you're interested, we'd love to have you.
Here's what some of the participants said they like about Free to Move.
Seeing all my friends.
Hanging out with people with the similar interest of musical theatre.
Spending time with friends and also making up different choreographs.
I like making friends and all the dance choreography.
I got all of them.
You know what I like about Free to Move is dancing and performing.
Free to Move's next show starts at 6 p.m. on Saturday the 21st of June. Head down to the Mercury Showgrounds to watch the group in action.
Princess was a sight lovely to see.
If you or someone you know would like to join Free to Move, rehearsals take place every night at 6 p.m. There are no additions and everyone is welcome. You can join any Friday at 6 p.m. in the Mount Showgrounds. They are a fun and friendly group and would love to see you there.
Splendid, absolutely marvellous.
Hi, I'm Max,
And in this audio feature, I'm going to take you inside the shadows of one of the most terrifying movie monsters ever created, the Xenomorph from Alien. In 1979, audiences around the world were introduced to a nightmare hidden in the dark, a creature unlike anything they'd seen before. The Xenomorph didn't just terrify, it redefined science fiction horror. But what made it so unforgettable? Let's step into the darkness and find out. The terrifying beauty of the Xenomorph began with the surreal and disturbing art of H.R. Giger, a Swiss artist known for blending the mechanical with the biological. Director Ridley Scott discovered Giger's work in a book called Necronomicon, one painting titled Necronom 4, caught his attention. The creature had an elongated skull, biomechanical textures, and a hauntingly elegant form. It was alien, yet almost human. Giger was hired to bring this vision to life. He didn't just draw it, he sculpted and painted every part of the creature himself. The Xenomorph's head was especially complex. It was part skull, part machine, with a long, smooth dome. Hidden underneath were mechanical parts and even pieces of a human skull. And that second inner jaw could shoot out with deadly force. Inside the head, animatronics allowed the jaw to extend, drool to drip, and life to flicker behind the monster's eyeless stare. To bring the full creature to life, they needed a performer who could move in an otherworldly way. The performer was Bolaji Badejo, a Nigerian graphic design student discovered in a London pub. He was almost 7 feet tall and incredibly slender, perfect for Geiger's vision. The suit he wore was made from latex, plastic, and real bones, with ribs and tubes stretching across his body. Badejo studied mime and movement so he could glide silently, like a predator, through the ship's narrow corridors. The first full appearance of the Xenomorph happens over an hour into the film. The crew of the Nostromo is searching for Jonesy, the ship's cat. Brett enters a dark, dripping room, alone. Water falls from the ceiling. Chains clink. He finds the cat, but behind him, something unfolds. The Xenomorph emerges from the shadows, its towering frame, its glistening head, and the hissing jaw. Quick, brutal, and unforgettable. But here's what most people don't realise. The Xenomorph is only on screen for about 4 minutes in the entire film, yet it became one of the most iconic monsters in cinema history. Why? Because Ridley Scott knew that what you don't see is often scarier than what you do. The alien wasn't shown in trailers, it didn't appear in posters, audiences went in blind, and the terror snuck up on them. The film used darkness, sound, and suggestion to keep the creature just out of sight. That suspense made every glimpse more terrifying. The Xenomorph didn't need to roar, didn't need to talk, it waited in the dark, and that was what made it unforgettable. Not just a monster, but the nightmare was a pulse. This has been In the Shadows, the Xenomorph of Alien. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.